Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, Dave Plyer with you on 720 WGN. So as you know, the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago has been near and dear to my heart for the past 15 years, but it has been the passion and life of this man's for 35 years. Bruce Dumont is the founder, CEO, and president of the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. And to share that journey with us, Bruce joins us this morning. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
So 35 years ago, you started a decades-long journey with a handful of dollars in your pocket.
$250 and an idea.
Yeah.
And it has just grown from where it is. And, you know, we have an event, obviously, Saturday night that we're bringing together some people that were with the museum early on, and some people as well as yourself who's committed so much of your recent life to the museum. And one person that's going to be very special to me is that the person that said that she supported the idea is Amanda Rudd. She was the library commissioner under Jane Byrne. I learned about 2 weeks ago that she passed away several years ago. She had moved to Washington. I did not know that. But the deputy that she put me in charge, pointed me to and said, talk to Mary. Anything you need, she's going to be your guide dog along this whole process. Her name is Mary Geekus, and she's now a senior vice president of the American Library Association, and she's going to be there, and I'm really looking forward to seeing her again.
Yeah, yeah. So that organization, plus, was it the local television academy that was also involved in this and gave you the money, or how did that all
come together? Yeah, well, I brought the idea up at a November meeting in 1982 at the Chicago Television Academy board. They were looking for a way to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the chapter, so I raised my hand and I said, I think there should be a broadcast museum in Chicago, because I had seen the disarray that occurred at WBBM-TV where I worked. Nobody really was taking care of old films and 2-inch tape at that point. And so Bob Smith, who was the president, said, Dumont, you're a committee of one. Go work on it. And a couple of months later, they appropriated $250. But that's sort of how it evolved.
$250 35 years ago. How much is in your pocket now?
In my
300? Is it up a little? Okay. All right. You spent most of your life before the museum in broadcasting, so you obviously have a personal tie to all this. And people always ask me if you're the son of Alan Dumont, who started Dumont Television in 46. 10 years before that, he was manufacturing the earliest forms of television. But he was your uncle.
He was my uncle, right. Yeah. And on my 10th birthday in 1954, my father and I, we went on a father-son visit to New York. He was going back for a reunion at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute up in Detroit, New York, which is where Alan Dumont also went. And so on that day, my 10th birthday, I got the boss's nephew tour of the Dumont TV studio. And I walked into a TV studio, 10 years old, and I met Captain Video.
Yeah, how cool is that?
And I sat in the spaceship, and I saw the sets were all made out of cardboard, and he signed in, a script, and it was a defining moment. I've never wanted to do anything other than that since my 10th birthday.
Now, some generations would know Captain Video from the Honeymooners episode, of course, Norton was watching, and the first, actually, I think it was the first 39 of the episodes when they bought a TV.
Well, I would say in 1954, I was 10 years old. Probably about 90% of the 10-year-old boys in America watched that show.
Yeah, that was it.
I mean, it was a huge show at its time.
And that experience, of course, was your inspiration to get into this.
Yeah, to get into the business. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, the network went belly up. They went out of business a year later.
People have to know that network was one of...
It was the first.
First.
It was the first.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the first, and they did not survive. There was some bad business decisions made, but so my uncle was not around to open any other doors for me other than that door to that very first tour.
That's very cool.
My 10th birthday.
Yeah, no, I love that story. And the broadcasting business in Chicago for you started right here on WGN Radio in 1968, I believe.
Yes, but.
But.
Before that, in the late 50s, I started literally right downstairs from where we are doing this podcast today. Nathan Hale Court.
Oh, okay. All right.
Nathan Hale Court every night at 5:45. A guy by the name of Ernie Simon, who was Scott Simon's father from NPR, he would have a show called Curbstone Cut-Up, 15-minute show sponsored by Walton Motors. And he would interview people walking by on the street.
Wow. Yeah, a lot of man on the street stuff. That was a
well.
Big thing
my
there.
Friend and I, who we lived in Logan Square, when it was raining out, we knew that adults were not going to stop to be interviewed to fill that 15 minutes. So whenever it was raining, we'd hop on the 76 bus on Diversity Avenue.
That's great.
It would drop us off right in front, and we would just be sort of standing around, looking around, and Ernie Simon or his substitute Jack Brickhouse would, on many occasions, pull us over and fill time with these 13-year-old kids.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And what did you produce here at the station at GN?
First thing I produced was Extension 720. Oh. I was one of the original producers of Extension 720, and that led to the Bill Berg Show, to the Howard Miller Show, to the WGN Sports Sunday Afternoon. I did Blackhawk hockey. I came up with Rich King, who went on to great fame in the city. We came up with the concept of an audio replay of a goal, a Chicago Blackhawks goal.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool stuff. WLTD, which is now WGC. Was where you kind of started off on the air, right?
Right on the air with Chuck Shaden gave me the opportunity. I called into a show one day. Norman Mark of the Daily News, the TV critic and radio critic, was there. Norman and I knew each other, so we chatted a little bit on the air. And at the end of the interview on the air, Chuck said, "Why don't you give me a call? Let's chat." And so a couple of weeks later, I went over there because I did want to go from behind the scenes to in front of the scenes, or in front of the mic. And I started in January of 1974 with a Daily Show on WLTD.
Did you know Dean back then,
which
too?
Which is now. Dean Richards
was around that time, right?
Dean Richards was an engineer at that particular time. We know it. And ironically, or I guess as this business goes, a couple of years ago when the Big 89 decided that they were going to cancel my show Beyond the Beltway after 22 years, I was going to be off the air for the first time ever in Chicago since 1973. And who calls me but 1590, it's now called WCGO, 1590 AM, which is the call letters that I was on when I started my career. And they have put the show, and that's now my Chicago affiliate. So
there was no gap there. Absolutely.
I walked up the same studio where I started.
It is the same studio.
It is the exact same studio.
That's cool.
I've originated the show from there on two occasions in the last 3 years.
That's cool. Very cool. And then you did BBM, Lee Phillip, I know. That's kind of how I knew who you were, was the Lee Phillip show, because my grandmother used to watch that show. So I know you were there, and I saw your credits in there.
No, Lee, the Noon Break with Lee Phillip, that started in 1978, and then I did some eventually did some radio and fill-in work for Dave Baum on WBBM radio. When he was on vacation.
And then WTTW did Chicago Tonight.
Yes, I was the original producer of Chicago Tonight. That started in 1984, and I left them, 10 years later. I worked at WTTW for exactly 10 years.
Wow. And as you noted, like many others, TV stations, radio stations were literally not handling their content very well, tossing out tape, film, artifacts. It wasn't important to anybody. And that's kind of what caught your attention. And you knew it kind of caught your attention throughout the years. It was building up in your head a little bit.
It was, but to even go back to the experience in at WBBM television, when I was a student at Columbia College in the 60s, 1966, we're going back a long way. Mm-hmm. There was a daily television show on Channel 7 called the Jim Conway Morning Show.
Right. Yep.
It was before videotape, so they would, it was on for 2 hours every day. They would do a dozen filmed pieces every day, and they would all be, they had be labeled, and they had to be cataloged. So I was hired to organize the film library of this daily television show, and I organized. And then they moved it from point one to point two after I was there for about 9 months. And in the course of the movement, they got all the boxes screwed up.
Yeah.
So the only person that knew how to put the system back together was me. But I basically started as a film archivist.
Yeah, but you knew that was happening at other stations around town too, obviously.
Oh, yeah, no.
Or even because, handled worse.
Oh, it was handled worse.
Yeah,
but the
yeah.
point is, you know, the ability and the desire to organize tape so that you could access it at a later point, that started when I was in college.
Yeah.
Although the exciting part of my job was when I got a chance to produce segments,
sure.
which I started doing in July of 1966. But I was, you know, answering the phone and doing the mail and making sure all the tapes were properly stored.
And here we are 35 years later.
I'm doing the same thing, Dan. Same
thing.
I have not changed at all.
Yeah. yeah. Over 200 events, or nearly 200 events and programs have been produced at the museum with some really big names over the years, and Radio Hall of Fames,
yep.
and I mean big names. 85,000 hours of audio and video content, a lot of it which is being digitized. 20,000, I think, artifacts. Am I correct?
Yes.
20,000 artifacts. All that kind of came in over the years. Some I know you went after. Some were offered to you, right?
Right. For the most part, it's either talent or producers or, to a large extent, engineers that decide that there's something that happens. They kind of squire it away in their basement. Management generally doesn't care, and they don't save it at all. There's not much of a preservation legacy of television executives. But over time, people, you know, they run out of space in their basement. They say, well, you want to help us? And
yeah.
that's how it arrives.
Some of those early board members. When I remember seeing the list of names when you and I first spoke almost 15 years ago, and I looked at it, I'm like, wow, are you kidding me? I mean, besides the Paul and Angel Harveys, who were really such a massive part of our early success, and really right until the end, they were a very big part
Absolutely.
Of the institution. Steve Allen?
Yes, Steve Allen. Steve Allen is the person who, on our behalf, called NBC to save the Tom Snyder shows that were about to be destroyed by some executive.
The Tomorrow Shows.
The original, you know, basically the soundtrack of the 1970s. We were able to preserve that because somebody made a call. Frances Bergen, who is the mother of Candace Bergen, who donated Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer Snerd and Effie Clinker to the museum. She made an integral call to Lou Wasserman, who was the most popular, most powerful person in Hollywood, and he opened all kinds of doors. And so the story of those 35 years, I mean, there is just when it looked like things were going to be very bleak, there was always something that came along.
Right, right.
But again, you know, Betty White, you know, Larry King, who unfortunately is going through some rough times now, has been a tremendous friend over the years. And so, here's a question that I don't even think you know, because I don't think I bring it up very often.
All right.
You know who made the first major donation of a celebrity nature, the first one that made a donation, $10,000?
Okay.
Mike Wallace.
Oh. Yeah, no, I knew. You know what? I see him in a lot of pictures in those early days and those celebrations and the opening at River City and all that other good stuff, because you've been at River City, you've been at the Cultural Center, and now, of course, we're on State Street, that great street.
One of the very first celebrities, I was out with John Calloway. We were doing an interview at the Palmer House for Chicago for an interview that John was doing. And that's when I first met Mike, and he asked me what I was doing, and I told him about the idea. He said, that sounds great. And he came back for our opening at the Cultural Center, and we did a salute to him in 1990. So throughout the first pitch at Wrigley Field, I mean, there are a lot of really great memories I have with Mike Wallace and with many of the people that I just referenced.
You know, we've done everything from classic shows and those events that we've had, you know, to celebrate Bob Hope's 100th, or some of the classic people that have been here throughout Chicago. Puppets, Pies, and Prizes, one of the biggest ones.
Smash.
It's a big smash. But then also more contemporary things. Jeff Garland from Curb Your Enthusiasm, the cast of Chicago Fire, Chicago PD. So we've touched a little bit of everything over the
years. Svengoolie.
Svengoolie. That was a fun one.
Big stuff. I mean, you're right. I mean, as I was looking at and I obviously, and as we have prepared for the exhibition that is currently at the museum, and the gala, which is celebrating the first 35 years, mm-hmm. I mean, I've just been inundated with these recollections.
It's cool.
And I will tell you,
it's
a
nice walk down memory lane. Yeah.
There's sometimes, Dave, when I've been down in the archives, I literally had to stop because I was overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed by, because everything leading up to that event was sort of all sort of cascading through my brain. So there are a lot of memories that are along this rocky 35-year road.
Yeah, yeah. Exhibits now in the museum. Charlie McCarthy, of course, you were talking about. Charlie will remain somewhere in the museum mm-hmm. as this new exhibit is coming up. But the story of radio is being re-envisioned.
Yes.
For
mm-hmm.
2019, I believe. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That part of that is the second floor of the museum, which has been the National Radio Hall of Fame, that is now going away at the moment. In preparation for the arrival of the Saturday Night Live exhibit, which is our biggest exhibit ever, opens in late October. And so that is going to be repositioned, and we're going to come back, I think, bigger and better with a look at radio as it's on the cusp of its 100th anniversary.
Yeah, that's very cool. I love that.
In 2020, it'll contemporize.
And we have to tip our hat to our chairman, Larry Word, for that.
Larry has made, not only has he made a significant contribution in basically shepherding and spearheading the idea to bring Saturday Night Live here. He was an integral part when he was over at NBC in really delivering a major donation from Comcast, which was monumental.
Absolutely.
And it was the final piece that allowed us to open at our new location.
Artifacts nationally, from I Love Lucy to Chicago Fire. So you think about the span of decades that we have at the museum. Of mm-hmm. course, there's the Bozo, the Garfield Goose, Ray Rayner Family Classics, Bill Jackson, Svengoolie. Artifacts from the Kennedy-Nixon debates that took place right here in Chicago. Jack Brickhouse. News sets from Meet the Press, the Tim Russert days. You can actually do the weather in one of our television studios. Doors to the Oprah Winfrey Show that she popped out of for so long.
Yeah.
An amazing media sculpture. And, of course, you said all this is captured in this 35th anniversary exhibit that people will see as well.
Right. I'm exhausted as you're running through the list.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great things.
There's a lot of stuff, and the other thing is that the definitive encyclopedias in the world,
right? Yeah,
on television, radio, and advertising have been authored by the museum. They're not vanity publications. These were the reference books of the year when they were published. We did two editions of television. So the fact that this was before Wikipedia really took off. But, I mean, we've had 350 academicians from all over the world write the essays that are part of the history, and that has become the foundation upon which we've done our public programs. So,
and the educational part of
the
our educational,
broadcasting museum. The depth is really there, and sometimes people forget that. But there's a lot of it's like the iceberg. The tip of the iceberg is what you see when you walk into the building at 360 North State. Everything else is deep in the bowels of the archives or available online.
Absolutely. Now, later this year, you've announced your plans to take a step back and enjoy life a little bit more. But if it wasn't for all your hard work and dedication to this institution that you began to assemble 35 years ago, so much, and this is 100% the truth, would be lost. Artifacts and content.
Well, yeah.
Nobody was going to do it. Nobody was going to keep it.
Nobody was doing it. And in the early days when I was trying to get people to join the plan here, they would pat me on the head and they would say, you know, somebody should have done this 20 years ago. And I said, well, let's not get together 20 years from now and say we should have done it 40 years ago.
Right.
So everybody sort of liked the idea, but nobody really took the time to say, okay, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And so there were key introductions at the time. And if you were to chart this, and perhaps it should be charted someday, if you were to chart how an idea grows, this is a great idea to chart. This sure. This led to this. This led to that. And one thing, by the way, I had received so many pats on the back.
Yeah.
And pats on the head.
Yeah.
Nobody wrote a check. I mean, in the first 7 or 8 months, nobody wrote a check.
Well, that's always still a struggle.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, as I was driving to one luncheon that was going to make the introduction to somebody in advertising, because I didn't know anybody in advertising, I literally said as I was driving into the lunch, I said, you know what? I've spent like 7 or 8 months on this. This is my last lunch. I'm tired of this thing. I'm not going to invest anymore. This is it. And that was the lunch that became the introduction to Rance Crane,
yeah,
of Crane of Advertising Age.
Yeah.
And after that lunch, I went back and I received a call from the general manager of ABC in Chicago, Dennis Watson.
Right.
Who said that in the name of Fahey Flynn and Frank Reynolds, who had died 10 days earlier,
wow,
he was going to give me $5,000 for my idea. I called back Rance Crane, who I had just had lunch with 90 minutes earlier, and he said, that's terrific, kid.
Yeah.
I'll match it. So we went from zero to $10,000 in one afternoon.
That's amazing.
And everything now everything from that point is in the rearview mirror.
And there's so much of the national things that we have in our archives. There's a ton of local, but I think about all those local TV stations, because there's hundreds of them all over the country. Where's all that stuff? Where's all their content?
Yep.
A lot of it's probably gone.
A lot of it is gone, and that is unfortunate. And we've been able to preserve a lot of what we have here, but there's room for more. That's certainly
true.
And more and more now, people are realizing that there is some value in some of that content. So,
sure,
you know, along came the internet and they digitized it. I mean, you know, I mean, this was, you know, the first several years, you know, when CNBC went on, when they finally launched, the first several years of CNBC was content from Tom Snyder
that
guy was going to destroy if I didn't save it, thanks to, you know, Steve Allen. And Steve Allen, by the way, called David Letterman. It was Steve Allen to David Letterman. This was when Letterman was at NBC. He put the kibosh on it being, you know, destroyed, and we ended up getting it.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I'm going to tell you what. You can see this journey in this 35th anniversary exhibit at the NBC, as well as all the local children's shows that so many of us grew up with. And starting in late October, Saturday Night Live, the experience, that will open up at the Broadcast Museum. And for tickets, you can visit snltheexhibition.com or visit museum.tv, and you can catch Bruce on his weekly show Beyond the Beltway, which has been airing across the country since 1980. You can catch it in Chicago on Sunday starting at 6 on 1560. That's WCGO. AM 560, the Sirius POTUS channel 124, and there's a TV version too later on Sunday nights on WYCC. Bruce, thank you, man. Thanks for hanging out, man. Appreciate it. All right, top stories are next.
Thank you for all your help, by the way.
Appreciate that. Thank you, sir. All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN.